Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think most people come back to some kind of normality, and for some people, it may be a freer normality than the previous one. I mean, I don't think we should ever be grateful for the terrible things that happen. But sometimes the world we build afterwards might be better than the world we had before, which doesn't mean it was a price worth paying. I think the challenge is not to be dominated by fear. And I think often where children are involved, they will model to adults how to get on with your life because they're changing all the time anyway, and they don't want to be held back by the bad things. They will accept it, integrate it, and move on. And I think if the adults around them can learn from that, that can be a great source of strength.
Is religion a money-making business, a commodity to be bought and sold? And will the deregulation of the religious marketplace foster more harmonious and peaceful societies? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions and meet with two robust and expansive thinkers. One a writer and teacher, the other a theologian and peace activist. Writers with tremendous empathy, courage and perspective. British writer Sarah Moss talks the NHS, parental love and the impact of time poverty on everyday family life. And Norwegian theologian and academic Torkel Brekke unpacks his latest book, Faithonomics, Religion and the Free Market. This is a show about fear and uncertainty, monopolies and marketplaces, and a new take on religious freedom. But first, the Tidal Zone with Sarah Moss.
I'm Sarah Moss. I'm a professor at Warwick University, mostly these days a novelist. I live in the West Midlands, which is the place I've started to write about now after years of writing about Cornwall and the far north. I'm an obsessive knitter and I really like long distance running. I'm going to read to you from my fifth novel, The Tidal Zone. It's about a family who is struck by sudden disaster. The narrator is Adam, a kind of part-time jobbing academic, but mostly a stay-at-home dad. And he's married to Emma, a GP. They have two daughters, 15-year-old Miriam and 8-year-old Rose. And it's Miriam who's struck by disaster. And I'm starting very near the beginning of the novel with our main character, our narrator, Adam, about to hear the news that will change his world and the world of his family. This section is called You Can Imagine It. There are no premonitions. The fact that you're eating a barely acceptable sandwich or devoting unjustifiable intellectual energy to your latest contribution to a social networking site doesn't mean that you're not in the interval between losing everything you take for granted and finding out that you have lost it. In the era of instant communication, that interval still exists. Even as you read this, someone, a police officer or a teacher or a colleague, the person playing the angel of death in the script you didn't know you were following, may be taking a deep breath, remembering the workshop on sharing bad news. As he or she prepares to dial your number and say the words we've all imagined, the words with which we torture ourselves, as if thinking about this possibility, admitting it to our minds, will keep it in the realm of nightmare and fantasy. There's been an incident. Imagining things does not stop them happening, nor does not imagining them. People, mostly parents in the school playground, which of course one of us still had to attend twice daily for Rose, said, "I can't imagine what you and Emma must be going through." "It is exactly as you imagine it," I said. "When you read accounts of ordinary lives disrupted by sudden disaster, by the ice on the road or the sleepy lorry driver, or the plane falling from the sky, or the angry young men with military hardware and nothing left to lose, when you shiver and turn the page, it is like that. You can imagine it. What you imagine is correct. This is not what they, the parents, wanted me to say."
Really well done on the book, Sarah. It's an absolutely hugely affecting novel on so many themes related to the family, but mainly I think about anxiety and uncertainty. Can I ask you, when you set out to write the book, what questions were you asking yourself?
I was thinking about the new normal, which is familiar to so many people, and there wasn't a particular personal experience that made me start thinking about this, but, you know, as you get into your 40s, things begin to happen to your family and friends. You have more experience of the world. More of the people you know are dealing with sudden and unexpected changes and meeting grief and disaster. And I was fascinated by the way narrative works in those situations, because I think mostly we all have a story for ourselves. We imagine ourselves at a point in the story, and we may not want to think very much about the ending, but we know the beginning and we know where we think we are at the moment. And when something happens, whether it's a diagnosis or a car accident or sometimes a sudden political change, that narrative is broken, and yet we keep going. And I was interested in those breaks, in the way those breaks in lived experience can be met by a broken narrative.
Do you think we have forgotten in some ways, with all technology and with how we're living and the pace of life, that we almost forget how fragile life is?
Yes, I do think that. And I think we live in isolation from death at the moment. And it's easy to think that death is something that happens to other people or to the very old, and it happens out of sight in hospitals where we don't have to think about it. I guess from talking to Irish friends, this may be a bit more the case in England than in Ireland. But still, I think it's all been sanitized and brushed away in ways that are historically very alien. I mean, most people in most countries in the world now, and in most of history, would have known loss and grief and bloodshed and sickness very early and as part of normality in a way that we no longer do.
Sarah, you've a beautiful passage in the book where you write, "We all live in patterns we do not see. We are all following magic ravens, yeah, even when we are lost. Otherwise, there would be no story." I found that so profound and so true. And it's these truths that are facing us, yet we just don't seem to see them.
We avoid them until they come and get us, but they do come and get us. They come and get all of us eventually. And when that happens, you need a story, actually. You need a story to keep going. It's very hard to live without one. So we find them. We find them in stories about brokenness, or we believe that there's hidden meaning and that if we keep going, the meaning will become clear to us. That maddening thing people say sometimes, "Ooh, everything happens for a reason." Of course it doesn't, but it's something that we need to believe, because without a reason, it's almost impossible to keep going.
It's one of the best openings I've read in a long time, what you wrote. It's incredibly powerful, very emotional, incredibly sensuous. You said to me earlier that you wrote the opening few pages in one straight sit. I find that really surprising, but it must have been such a flow that you just couldn't stop, because it reads so vibrantly. The pitch to it, it's quite something.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the only thing I've ever written that we've published in first draft. I think normally I'm an obsessive rewriter and editor of sentences and commas, and I move the punctuation around and I try how a different simile would look and then I change it back again. And that passage, I just wrote it. And then I stuck it at the beginning of the book, and I thought I'd probably go back to it, but I didn't. And then when I sent it to my editor, he really loved it. And we didn't really discuss it, but we just kind of quietly, tacitly ignored it from there on in.
Presumably, though, in terms of writing all your other books, this is your fifth novel,
yeah,
that it hasn't essentially happened like that all the time. And it's a question of just, or a matter of sticking at it and persisting and redrafting and,
yeah,
rereading and more redrafting. But you can, I think, when you read something that so flows and there's a musical quality to it as a reader, that it just, it takes life its own.
Yes, and actually I never read that bit when I'm doing readings, because I still sometimes cry when I read it. I think if the author's crying, what hope is there for the audience, really? So yes, it's just become the kind of unspoken thing that sits there at the beginning.
So how did you begin to write about family trauma and the uncertainties in life? It's a particularly affecting story of a young girl who was diagnosed with a very rare condition. Can you tell me about it?
I came across that much later. I knew I wanted to write about a sudden intervention in an apparently ordinary and happy and well-ordered life. And I went through various possibilities, but I wanted something that might happen again, because I think that is really the human condition. And sometimes, you know, if something terribly unlucky happens to you, there's a need to think, oh, well, at least my bad luck has happened to me now. Nothing else is going to happen. But we know it's not really like that. Having one piece of bad luck is no guarantee that you're not going to have another. So I wanted to write about a family who were living with the reality of that truth, that one bad thing happening is no guarantee that another bad thing won't happen. And it was actually, well, there were two things that suggested Miriam's condition to me. One of them was that we have friends in London for whom we house sit often. We've been doing it for years. And once we'd been staying there, and I'd bought some peanut butter for the kids because we like it, and when we left, there was half a jar left, so I left it in the cupboard because he's going to carry half a jar of peanut butter around the country. And a few months later, I was talking to my friend, and she just mentioned quite casually that one of her kids has a potentially fatal reaction to peanuts. I thought, oh, I cannot believe it. You know, they must have had to fumigate their house, and I felt terrible about it. And I said, I'm so sorry I left peanut butter in your house. I can't be. I would never have done that if I'd known. And I'd known her for years, and she'd never mentioned it. And she said, oh, we don't make a fuss. We just teach him to avoid peanuts. And I thought, she's been carrying that around all these years, and she hadn't kept it secret from me particularly. We just never talked about it. Suddenly, her whole life looked different to me. And knowing that there's a substance out there in the world that can kill you very quickly.
And trusting the world will not do that to you.
Yes,
if
it
you
might.
Will. It got me thinking, though, that we have the NHS, which is quite similar to our health service here in Ireland.
Yes.
And that almost is a character in the book in terms of how you write the kind of the atmosphere, the stillness at night. But it got me thinking that within the crappy food, within the overstretched nursing services, within the high pressure environments, that at least we have functioning health systems here.
Yeah.
Because when you think about all around the world, if this was a story of a child maybe somewhere in Africa or possibly, let's say, look at Syria.
Indeed, yes. And I was thinking about that all the time I was writing, because that's one of the impossibilities once you start thinking about luck and bad luck. I mean, I've been talking about the terrible bad luck that comes to this family, but it's also extraordinary good luck, because the paramedics get there, there's a defibrillator, there are people who know what to do, and then she's taken off to a very well-equipped hospital, which may not feed her very well and may not care for her need for privacy and dignity and something to do, but nonetheless is able to give her the treatment that she needs in order to return to her life and her education. One of the starting points for this novel was one day, must have been 2 or 3 years ago, and I had the Today programme on in the mornings on Radio 4, I always do, and I was making the packed lunches and putting the kids' breakfast together, you know, going up every 5 minutes to shout, it's 7:30, get out of bed, it's 7:35, get out of the shower, you two are going to be late if you don't get on with it. And in between, listening to the news, and there was an interview with a journalist in Syria, and he'd recorded a conversation which ended with a man standing in the rubble of his house shouting, where is the world? Why is the world not listening to us? Where is the world? And I froze in my kitchen thinking, here, I'm here, I can hear you. You know, the BBC has done its job, I hear your voice. But I don't know what to do about it. I can't react in any useful way. And I kind of went through my day haunted by that. And when my kids got back from school, they told me that a child, there'd been some collision on the football pitch. It wasn't anything like what happens to Miriam, but the air ambulance had been called and the child had been taken to hospital. And I thought, so we live in a world where on the same day, at one end of the Mediterranean, helicopters come and shoot people and bomb their houses and kill children. And at the other end of the Mediterranean, a helicopter comes to rescue a child who's broken a leg and take him to hospital. And the impossibility of living with that became part of the novel.
Yeah, when you think that through, it becomes so overwhelmingly disgusting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's actually hard to put a word in it. Now, one of the interesting aspects of the title zone is that our two parents, Emma, who's a family GP, and Adam, who's a stay-at-home dad, they're dealing with a lot of juggling priorities. Time poverty, I suppose, is the best way to describe it. They're completely exhausted. They're quite frazzled. And how they're trying to negotiate their own lived timetables of how they get through any day. It seems that just basic parental life is taxing. Is that something you feel very strongly about?
I think we need fiction and literature of the everyday, and I think that's been missing from a lot of more serious literary work over a long time. I mean, I'm thinking 200-300 years. This is not a comment about my fellow novelists of the present day, but I'm interested in a kind of literature that doesn't marginalise the amount of time that some people spend putting socks in the washing machine and getting them out again, or making the packed lunches. And some readers say, oh, you know, she writes about another pot of pasta. And I think, yes, but we spend so much time over our pots of pasta. Why should it not be written about? Why should there not be a literature that takes that domestic work seriously? And I think part of the answer to that question is because for years and years and years, it's been done by women and therefore considered to be boring and beneath notice.
But the interesting thing in the title zone is Adam is quite good at the family lunchbox,
yeah,
and has a particular fascination with healthy food, and he's very particular, and he almost, how he loves us through food, which is very interesting. But it got me thinking, do you think we've got over all our cultural barriers about stay-at-home dads?
No, I think there's still a sense that it's a weird thing to do. My husband was our stay-at-home dad for years, and he found that particularly women would tell him how wonderful he was and what a great job he was doing. Mm. And, you know, he was doing a perfectly decent job. The kids were well-fed and healthy and clean, and it was fine. I'm not suggesting that he wasn't doing a good job. But people used to tell me how really lucky I was that my husband would change nappies and put the wash on. And I don't think anybody ever told him how lucky he was that I would go out to work all day. So there was a sense that what's completely normal and boring when a woman does it becomes some kind of heroic task when a man manages to complete it. And he found that as annoying as I did. And of course,
it's absolutely ridiculous. But it also suggests that women don't trust their partners or husbands or whoever it is to actually think that they are up for the job and can do a good job of parenting, in the sense of pack the lunches, get the clothes washed, cook the dinner without burning it, you know, whatever, the administer medicine, whatever it is, that they actually have the wherewithal to do it. They don't trust them.
I think it's a learned skill. And I think, like any kind of delegation, whether it's at home or at work, you have to accept that another person learning to do it is going to mess it up at the beginning and may then not do it the way you would do it. But we all cope with that in the workplace, and I don't think it's at all difficult to cope with it at home. I mean, of course, I was the one who took the maternity leave, so when I first went back to work, I did have a huge skill set that my husband didn't have. But he's a perfectly intelligent human being who'd been competent in all sorts of workplaces for many years. You know, give him a week and he's going to work out how to bath the baby, change a nappy, get Calpol into them when you need to, whatever it is. So I think there are reasons why women find it hard to accept that men will be able to take over and do the job, because we're still held responsible for it. I mean, if people come and look at your house and it's a mess, they won't usually blame the man. Culturally, we're held responsible for the childcare and the domesticity. And certainly all the time that my husband was at home and I was working full time, whenever there was anything in the papers about children, it was always mother's fault. And I used to show them to him and say, see, it's your fault. You're the primary carer.
Did you spend a lot of time in hospitals, Sarah? Because there's some beautiful lines, like on the children's ward, parent sadness comes out at night. I found that unbelievably beautiful and very, very sad. But there was a real mood to how you wrote the hospital passages, and quite a reflective mood in it. So I'm just wondering, did you spend some time in hospital yourself when you were younger? Or how did you go about all of that?
Mostly it's just fiction. One of my kids was in hospital for a while years ago, and he was much, much younger. But yeah, some of that's coming from personal experience.
Do you think we can all cope eventually with the chaos, whether it's some form of catastrophe that affects a family? Do you think that we can eventually, as people, or that we can endure and become resilient enough to actually just deal with when something terrible happens, that we can get over it and the terrible becomes the normal and we can manage our way around it? Do you think that's possible for all families?
I think most people come back to some kind of normality, and for some people it may be a freer normality than the previous one. I mean, I don't think we should ever be grateful for the terrible things that happen. But sometimes the world we build afterwards might be better than the world we had before, which doesn't mean it was a price worth paying. I think the challenge is not to be dominated by fear. And I think often where children are involved, they will model to adults how to get on with your life, because they're changing all the time anyway, and they don't want to be held back by the bad things. They will accept it, integrate it, and move on. And I think if the adults around them can learn from that, that can be a great source of strength.
Eli, which is Adam's father, spent some time in intentional communities. This is part of the backstory of the book, and it's beautifully woven into the main narrative. I'm just wondering, intentional communities, have you ever lived on one, or why did you choose to have that as Eli's backstory?
I haven't lived on one. I've always been interested in them. I think I'm far too much of an introvert, actually. I've never read about an intentional community where you can go off and spend most of your time on your own reading, or indeed on your own going for long runs somewhere else. I'm interested in them as a counter to the family, and I've been interested in institutions and intentional communities throughout my writing career, because it seems to me that they're the most viable alternative we have to family life, and I'm always interested in comparing them. Anna Freud, who set up wartime nurseries for children in England during the Second World War, was quite consciously doing experiments to see if institutions could do a better job of raising kids than families. And that's a question that continues to fascinate me. I think the answer may be fairly clearly no in most cases, but then there are certainly families where one would rather be in an institution. And institutions seem to me to be such utopian ideas that you can, rather than just sinking into the kind of well-meaning model of most family lives, you can actually draw up a set of aims and a set of rules and try to live well or do the job of raising kids or educating them or being fair or whatever the aim is according to regulations and live by principles. It's a very intriguing idea. I mean, I don't know that it often works very well.
But the optimistic side of that is the intention and the attitude of living better or finding better structures in order for communities to thrive and flourish.
Because clearly
we're living through deep felt sense of stagnation within communities. We've a lot of isolation. We've a lot of disparities between the right communities, so to speak, or the rich or well-off communities, and then those which are on the fringes.
Yes, and I'm interested in ways of addressing that and thinking differently about how people live with each other. And usually these days when we hear the word community, it's some politician being rude about a community of which he or she doesn't imagine him or herself to be part. But there are some very utopian ideas which I like to take very seriously about ways we could do things better by choice.
And that was British author Sarah Moss. The Tidal Zone is published by Granta Books and retails for in or around €18 in paperback. I can also recommend some other of Sarah's big reads, including Night Walking, Cold Earth and Signs for Lost Children, again all published by Granta Books.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What effect has the internet on religion? Is atheism a religion? And what religious goods do Buddhism or Hinduism offer? In Faithonomics, Religion and the Free Market, Norwegian writer and academic Torkel Brekke argues, if governments and societies could start to see religious organisations as firms selling products or as clubs, many of the current anxieties about religion could be reduced. Torkel goes on to argue, there is nothing immoral or imperialist in the market perspective on religion. This perspective on religion does not entail disrespect of religion or religious people. It does not mean reducing the value and meaning of faith. In short, the market perspective can clarify and strengthen the arguments for freedom of religion throughout the world. So, do we need to find a new way to think about religion?
Hello, my name is Torkil Brekke. I'm a Norwegian. I live in Oslo in Norway, and I'm a professor in the study of religion. I work at the Peace Research Institute here in Oslo, and my line of research is about the way that religion relates to politics. I've written a book called Fundamentalism, Prophecy and Protest, it's a few years ago, and now I published a book called Faithonomics, which is about religion and the free market.
What an interesting read, Faithonomics, Torkil. It's so surprising in parts, really eye-opening in other parts. I might throw you a big wide-open question to start off with. And considering that you brought the great Scottish philosopher and political economist into the book, I might start with him, Adam Smith. Adam Smith once wrote that all money is a matter of belief. Do you think he's a point there?
Absolutely. I think if we all lose trust in money and finance at the same time, everything would break down. So it's absolutely a matter of faith. And of course, Adam Smith is one of my heroes as well. And I use him a lot in my book.
Do you think it could be argued, Torkil, that there are markets for a religion? And what I mean by that is that there are markets for religious ideas, goods and services, that we can look at religion as a commodity?
Oh, absolutely. And that's my core argument in the book. There are markets for religious services, goods, and so on. And I think that claim shouldn't be really controversial, because if you look at a church or a mosque or any kind of organization like that, we all realize that the services that are being produced there, that they have to be paid by somebody. And we as consumers or as users of those services, we generally pay by taxes or through sort of donations or maybe even membership fees in some countries. So looking at this from a market perspective shouldn't really be, in my opinion, that difficult.
Did you read Freakonomics by any chance?
Oh, yes, I did. And what struck me about Freakonomics was that those guys, they didn't really look at religion at all. They looked at more or less everything else, but they left sort of the faith and God out of their economic thinking, even though the Freakonomics sort of universe came to several books and so on. So yes, I did.
Faith is different from butter and haircuts. After all, religion is about really important questions. Will you tell me, Torkil, is there a God?
Oh, that's a very personal question. You know, asking somebody like me is horrible, because then I'll just ask back, what do you mean by God? It all depends. And if you ask me God in an old-fashioned sense, I would say no. But, you know, I also have great sympathy for philosophers, theologians, and so on, who argue for a much more nuanced and complex idea of God. So, and then you get me into more territory where I get more interested, you might say.
Well, Torkil, let me put it another way. If there are markets for religion, as you argue so finely in Faithonomics, presumably, by inverse, there's also markets for atheism.
Oh, definitely, yes. And one of the things I try to show is that one of the interesting things going on right now, especially in Europe, but also in North America and India, Australia, is that secular atheist organizations are actually competing with religious organizations like churches, mosques, etc. They're competing for followers, and they're also very often imitating, especially Christian rituals, Christian ways of performing religion in the way they sort of frame atheism. So that's really one of the more interesting fields of competition, you might say. You can see that especially here in Scandinavia, but also in Britain. You have a growing and interesting atheist communities. You know, they offer burials, they offer name-giving ceremonies, weddings, and so on.
I'm just wondering, Torkil, how do you go about measuring belief? Because it's not a clear-cut thing. Sure, it's not.
No, it's not. Absolutely not. And you have all these different surveys that try to measure what people believe in, and that obviously changes over time. You can see how belief in God, say, changes through the years and decades in different countries. But in my book, I'm not really that interested in belief in itself. I'm more interested in the tangible, the practical sides of religion. For instance, like all the rites of passage, the rituals that we need in our daily lives. For instance, when I take my children to a name-giving ceremony, say, or when I go to a church to get married, that's the kind of religion I'm interested in, because that's much more easier to measure, and it's also easier to see how different religions may compete in a market. So belief, of course, is important to many people, but it doesn't necessarily have to be important in measuring religion. Actually, some of the most important measurements have to do more with how frequently people go to church, for instance, or how much they donate to the local churches and so on. So that's more tangible, easy to measure, right?
I've always thought that where people equate belief with salvation is a very interesting space.
It is, and it's a very modern, or at least a very Christian, probably a Protestant idea, because if you look at many of the religious systems, say, in pre-modern, prehistoric, or if you look at indigenous peoples, they have no conception of salvation as Protestants do, but still, of course, they have religion. They have all the rituals, all the, you know, the music, the poetry, and everything that goes with religion. But salvation doesn't really have to be part of that equation.
Now, Torkel, you pitch up a very interesting question in the book. You ask, what happens to religious marketplaces when religion goes online?
Yes, because that's something we experience all around us, that everything goes online. All markets go online now. You know, we start buying our milk and bread online and so on. And that happens to religion as well. And I think there are many, many interesting things that happen when faith goes online. But basically, the two things that are really more important than others. And that's firstly that religion online empowers individuals. And that's because it makes it really easy for people to navigate around, find little bits and pieces of ideas, philosophy, theology that they put together to shape their own faith. The second thing is that religion online really challenges traditional authority in the sense that, you know, you don't really have to ask a priest or an imam or whatever what you can do on the internet, because you're your own boss in a way when you're online. So it empowers individuals and it challenges authority. One point connected to this is that this actually also happens offline.
I'm just wondering, though, how well can you do spiritual direction online, either from those who are providing the service or the recipient of the service? I'm just wondering how that all pans out.
That's a great question, actually. Let me give you an example. If you look at Hinduism today, there's a lot of online services. And one of the crucial things for a Hindu is what you call darshan in Hindi or in Sanskrit, and that means a sighting or a vision of a god. And traditionally, to get that, you would have to enter a temple and actually see the god, see the sculpture, the statue of the god inside the temple. But now there is this huge debate among Hindus about what happens when you actually watch, when you see the sculpture online instead. Can you have the same meaningful vision online, or is it different because you simply see the god or the goddess on the screen? And there's a real theological, really interesting discussions going on about questions like that now.
And also, when you think about it, the kind of more ambient aspects of ritual, because what you smell, the collective, all the different aspects has a big impact. And you certainly don't get that through a computer screen.
No, you're absolutely right. So I think you're pointing to something that is really important, namely the fact that religion online is not really developed yet. We have yet to see, you know, a real philosophical or a theological system developing online only. As you rightly point out, that there's no way you can get the full experience by looking at the screen. But I think that is changing too, because it's quite easy to imagine, I think, a situation in the future where we do have ways to experience more fully things going on in virtual reality. Think of gloves or you know, helmets or masks, whatever. So really to give a fuller experience. But we're not there yet. But this is changing really fast. So it's a fascinating development to look at.
You bring up the work of the Scottish sociologist Steve Bruce. He's a very well-known critic of the economic perspective of religion. He wrote God is Dead, Secularisation in the West, I think. He thinks very differently to you. He would argue, Torkel, that people generally do not see religions as interchangeable. They don't see it like cars or shopping or clothes. And he argues that religions demand complete faith of their adherents and demand their complete attention and loyalty. So what do you say to that challenge?
Steve Bruce and several other scholars believe that really talking about religious markets is meaningless, especially outside the modern West. And that's because in the modern West, we have decoupled religion from culture. And that means that it's easier to shop around for different religious products without leaving your culture. And somebody like Steve Bruce would say that this is a precondition for a religious market to exist. What I'm doing in my book is that I spend quite a lot of space, actually, several chapters, trying to show that these critics are wrong. The problem is that they look for ways where people can switch between, you know, these big systems, like going from Islam to Buddhism, from Christianity to Hinduism, whatever. And this is not where we should look for religious choice and shopping around. What has actually been going on through history, and this is my claim, is that within these huge world religions, these systems of faith and practice, there have been lots and lots of different ways to approach religion. Say, for instance, if you look at India 1,000 years ago, you would be able to switch between, you know, following this holy man, that holy man. He could be a Muslim, he could be a Hindu, he could be a Sikh. Well, not Sikhism, because that's a newer faith. But the point is that you can find points in history where people had lots of different choices to choose from in magical practices, in rituals, in following gurus or sheikhs or holy men, etc., without leaving their sort of overarching identity as a Muslim or Hindu or whatever. So that's where the critics have made a mistake, I think, because there have been markets for religion through history, but not in the sense of changing from these big entities to another.
Well, let's look at one of the more interesting religions out there, Buddhism. 500,000 followers throughout the world. What religious goods and services does Buddhism offer?
That all depends on where you look, because the world of Buddhism is very large. But to most people, of course, Buddhism, if you ask somebody in Thailand or Korea, Tibet, Buddhism would offer, for instance, certain life cycle rituals. It would be important around death, burial, things like that. It would offer a lot of what we might normally think of as magical services, ways to get health, medical practices, everything like that. And for a certain number of people, it would also be relevant to talk of salvation as one good on offer, but not for everybody, because, you know, people in their daily lives, they may not always think about that kind of thing. But there's a wide variety of products that people would be able to choose from in various Buddhist societies.
You write, in certain ways, Buddhist worldviews are actually better adapted to facilitate the exchange of goods and payments between producers and consumers than those of Christianity. Can you talk me through that?
Well, there is a sense in which, from the start, Buddhism saw itself as a moral economy, you might say, in the sense that you had an elite of monks and nuns, on the one hand, and on the other hand, you had the laity, the normal people. And the relationship between these two of Buddhist societies would be such that they would see this as an exchange, almost in economic terms. And actually, oftentimes, they do use economic terms to describe the way in which religious merit would be given by monks and nuns to lay people, to normal people. On the other hand, lay people would then donate food, buildings, robes, etc., all the things that, all the stuff, the material needs that the monks and nuns would need. So there would be an actual exchange One way there would be material goods, and the other way there would be religious goods, but also education and things like that coming from the Buddhist monks.
Torkel, some people would find an analysis of the religious world in terms of goods and services or a market-based perspective or framework on it as a little bit offensive, if not hugely offensive. Do you think some people are a bit, do you think critics of you who say that you can't just take religion and apply that type of economic analysis on it, do you think that is a bit precious, and do you think that's a redundant argument to make?
Well, I can understand the argument, because too many people face religion is really something that is very important to them. It is really about the meaning of life and so on. So I can appreciate and understand the argument, but I think it's wrong. And I tried to show that in my book by using other examples of things that we really appreciate that are important to us, but that we still analyze in a market perspective or with economic concepts. So I think that people who say that the economic look at religion is in itself bad, immoral, I think that's misunderstood. And also, I would point out that most of the founding fathers of social science, to put it that way, they would all be quite skeptic to religion, skeptic against it. And the best example, of course, is Karl Marx, who would say that, you know, religion is something really bad. It's a smokescreen that covers up the real facts and so on. So in a sense, all the social scientific theories that we have about religion, that they are far more critical of faith than the economic look, I would say. So, but there's an interesting discussion here about how we analyze social facts like religion, as scientists, as researchers, and normativity or the morality of what we do, which I think I really appreciate that discussion.
Well, let's look at the research then. You bring up the RAS data for 2008, and the RAS is the Religion and State data set. You have a very interesting statistic. You say that 81 out of 177 states provide government funding of religious primary secondary schools. So you work that out to be about 45.8%. That is quite a high amount, isn't it? I was quite surprised by that. Do you think that leaves the education sector and those recipients also in a very vulnerable position? Like, you're coming from a Lutheran country in Norway, where you have a lot of state subsidies to religious organisations. And I know Denmark is a classic case of religious state monopoly.
That's right. You're making a good point. And what I'm saying in the book is that, you know, I use Jonathan Fox, his research in several places in the book. And as you point out, that he has built this data set about how governments regulate and subsidize religion in different countries. And that's really important data. And if you look at that data, as you say, you will see that, for instance, schools, education is heavily intertwined with religious organizations all over the world. But you will also find that governments actually regulate and subsidize more and more. It's on the increase worldwide. So the interest that governments take in this sector is sort of intensifying in a way. I think we should ask ourselves why that is the case. I think part of the question has to do with increasing globalization, increasing sense of maybe a threat to identity, that governments in many places, they want to bolster national identities by subsidizing, by supporting a majority faith and putting that even more strongly into schools, into institutions and so on.
Now, Torkel, you write, if you ever want to start your own religious congregation, here is my advice. Go for a theology that says God is a woman. You also argue in the book that women are generally more religiously inclined than men. How did you come about that perspective?
Well, there's several surveys showing that women tend to believe more, have more faith, also practice religion more than men worldwide. But at the same time, if we look at people in the leading positions, the people who are the leaders of churches, mosques, all the organizations across the world, they all tend to be men. I mean, the percentage of women leaders in religious organizations is incredibly low. That is a strange paradox, isn't it? And I'm arguing in my book that, well, this may point to market failure, where we should address this problem, because it could well be that it is a consequence of discrimination, and that I think it is. I don't think it's the case that women simply don't want to be leaders of these types of organizations.
You pitch up another interesting question. I laughed my head off actually when I read it, and I had to read it a few times before I actually said, no, he's actually serious here. You write, why do atheists and Buddhists behave like Christians?
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the more interesting consequences of the way that modern states measure religion and try to put them all into the same format, if you will. If we look at the history of religions across the world, say the last 100 years, we can see that states in Europe, in America, and in Asia, and in Africa, they all want to measure religion in certain ways, and they put all these groups into boxes. They also subsidize, of course. They subsidize certain types of groups that fit these boxes. And the obvious consequence is that minority religions or the atheist organization today, in order to get the funding that others get, they need to tick the boxes and they need to fit the format, so to say. So there is a great convergence where both religious organizations but also atheist organizations, they become more and more similar simply to fit the template of the modern state.
Torkel, you argue that if governments and societies could start to see religious organizations as firms selling products or as clubs on a par with other secular clubs, many of the current anxieties about religion could be reduced. It's a very fine statement, but I'm wondering, is it a little optimistic?
It is a little optimistic, and I guess as a liberal, I try to be optimistic. And my point is that we're going in the wrong direction. As I said earlier in the program, there is a tendency for states all over the world to regulate and subsidize and intervene more and more in the market for religions. And that has a lot of consequences, a lot of unforeseen consequences. And so, in the end, my book is also an argument for freedom of belief, in the sense that if we're able to realize that people have always, to some extent, been able to choose between different religious products, worldviews, good services, it should be easier for governments to ease up their control, the way they control this field, and let people simply be more free in the way they relate to these organizations. And that's the main point in my book.
And do you think that's likely?
Oh, I wish I could say yes, but I'm afraid, as I said, it's going in the wrong direction. And I think the best we can hope for is to have a debate where we try to point out the bad consequences, the negative consequences of certain types of regulation, and tell politicians and tell governments that, look, if you do this, then this will happen. If you say that missionaries, for instance, are banned from your countries, then that type of regulation is actually associated with more persecution. And you find data about this, and you can establish these connections between different types of state intervention and different types of consequences. So I guess the best we can hope for is to have a good debate about that.
was Norwegian writer Torkel Brekke from the Peace Research Institute in Oslo. Faithonomics, Religion and the Free Market is published by Hearst Publishing and retails for around €25 in hardback. Now, I have to say, thought-provoking does not come close to describing this book. It's really quite something. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the sensible and prescient words of German economist, philosopher and writer Karl Marx, who once quipped, "I do not like money. Money is the reason we fight." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.